Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm happy to have as my guest Micheline Aharonian-Markham. She's been on the show with her first novel, which was called Three Apples Fell from Heaven, and now her second book has come out, The Daydreaming Boy. It's from Riverhead Books, and it continues her fictional exploration of the consequences of genocide, in this case, the Armenian genocide. The book follows one of the orphaned children who, having been evicted with his mother from an ancestral home, is deposited in an adoption home and then eventually becomes an adult in Beirut. Now, you say that the book began, in a sense, by wondering what happened to the children of the exile, because in the absence of writing, the attention got paid to the exile itself, and that you were looking at pictures of the orphans. Where do you find material like that?
You mean the photographs of the orphans?
Yes.
It's not terribly difficult to find the photographs. There are some quite actually prototypical photographs of the orphan, the Armenian orphan, that you'll see on many sort of websites, say, or that are in many Armenian books that are interested in the sort of promoting not the genocide, but the fact of it, say. So I had seen these photographs for many years while I was writing the first book, actually. And what I became interested in the second book is what happens afterwards, because the repercussions of war are long-term. They're for generations. And I was interested in particularly the case of an orphan, a refugee, someone who is completely unhistoried in the case of Vahe Chupjan in particular, because he doesn't know who his family is, and he can never know. He comes to consciousness in an orphanage, and there's no possibility of knowing who he was, where he came from, his ancestral lineage. This is just not possible. And that situation, I was interested in exploring that.
I thought I'd begin by asking Micheline Markham to read a section in which we see a photograph, essentially, of an orphan. This is from her novel, The Daydreaming Boy.
I have a photograph taken by a German soldier during the Great War. The German took his photos during his military duty in the Orient, and the photo is of a Harpetsi boy, black and white, Ottoman Empire, 1915. I found the reproduction in one of the Armenian journals, of which there are so many in Beirut, and its demands in bold letters that the demoniac race, confession, bear responsibility for the destruction and suffering of the Anatolian Armenian clans. In the photo, the child is covered head to toe in rags, in layers of torn cotton and wools. His feet are bare and his hands are invisible beneath two long sleeves. His feet splay as if they have done much shoeless walking. The boy is looking into the camera lens and squinting from the sun's light. He is looking up at the German soldier who rises above him. For years I have carried this photograph in my billfold, and occasionally I pull it out and stare back at the stare of the boy. I say he, for I have always thought him to be a boy, but it is impossible to ascertain the sex of this child. His sex is untellable from the photo, his name not knowable. He is rightly 6 or 7 years old. I cannot remember the name of the journal where I cut the picture from years ago, or in what month or year I began carrying it in my billfold, but I am certain it is not me in the likeness. This is certain not only because the child is older than I am, and we do not bear any resemblance to each other, but also because his look is one of sorrow and despair. He wears the mask of the orphan. He looks like an orphan, this boy whose mouth is open slightly, his lips a beautiful gray, as if he were going to speak, and what would a lost boy say to the foreigner? His look is the look of sadness. In this photograph, I can see it. It is not the rags that tell of it, his stance with the bared knee slightly bent, or the invisible hands. I assume he has hands. What marks the public sadness for this boy? I think it is his look to the German, what he must have hoped for in the European soldier. He stopped walking or begging and stood still for the foreigner, looked up at him calmly. See me, he doesn't say. I am the sad boy. See me. There have been hands to caress this child's flesh and hands to cradle me and hands in the darkness. Oh, he is a boy to have known sorrow. And he could very well have been my uncle, my mother's youngest cousin. We are kin in any case, kin made from an event in history. Not one moment, but many bound together and routed from hearths and bundled up in his raggy hat turban. There is, of course, the moment of the photograph. I have no idea if the boy survived, if the photo marks an arrival somewhere, or if he is still in the desert, if his bones have become part of the sanded landscape. The background of the photograph is blurred. Only the boy's shadow is distinguishable behind him, rising at a sharp angle like a tall building in the distance. He is a boy out of time, alone with his shadow, from an unknowable place and clan, and unlike me and unlike all of us, except the one from the boy's orphanage, he is a sad boy. He misses what he has known, the heat of the hearth, the open orchard with the figs hanging low and the pomegranates dipping to the ground from two heavy boughs, the soft voice at night, a lullaby. He is not rude and bitter. He did not crush the boy's hand who took his bread or beat the weak for their stupidity and their weakness. I love his sorrow and what I imagine to be a kind of chagrin. He has left childhood behind in the photograph. Perhaps it marked the end for him, but still there is a discernible childlike look to him, a trace left in his look and lean and slightly parted lips. I have no photos in my possession from my time in the orphanage, and so I cannot compare his photograph to mine. But I know we never had that look. The boys that were raised up in the Bird's Nest orphanage never wore the orphan's mask of sorrow and despair. We wouldn't have lasted out a week.
Micheline Aharonian-Markham reading from The Dreaming Boy. Now, this introduces all sorts of major themes in the book, that the boy, that the man speaking can look at a picture and only know that it's not himself, but they are kin, although they are probably not related. We're talking about history's necessary amnesia, in a sense, that enforced not knowing, that becomes part of the fog of the book. The book begins with a voice that only gradually emerges from the fog into a kind of clarity, but still circular. I wonder if you'd talk about that loss of knowledge.
Well, in so many ways, I was interested in sort of what I said already, this what is not knowable. And obviously in America, amnesia is part of the landscape here. But actually in the older cultures, and in other places, places like Lebanon, history is present, and it's part of life, and it's everywhere. And clan is so rooted, and blood is so important. Where you're from, who your blood is, your clan, etc. In the Middle East, that's very understood.
I am very interested in the kinds of amnesia and repression that operate not necessarily just in war, but in particular in your work. In this book, as in The Daydreaming Boy and the earlier book, Three Apples Fell from Heaven, there is a amnesia born of shame.
Yeah.
The pornography of war gives way to a private kind of pornography, and those two become, in a way, mysteriously linked. I think of it as being what is most characteristic in your work. People write about devastation, orphanage, all the time. The linkage of that to sexual humiliation.
I see.
To a shift in gender, you know, the confusion of gender. That seems to me to be specifically characteristic of the work you're doing.
I have no idea, in a way, you know?
In another way, I bet you do.
I probably do. I know that I'm always interested in what is going erased, sort of macro and micro. What's elided? What's erased? What's denied? What's the vulgar? And sort of the big themes for me, of course, the Armenian genocide is denied by the Turks. So there you go. Big historical denial. It makes Armenians crazy. And I have it too, even though I was, you know, raised here. So that's big. That's the macro, you know, historical, etc. But on the other hand, when I was researching the first book, and then this book too, which there was nothing written on these orphans. There's nothing. On orphans in general, there's so little, it's unbelievable. You know, I'm sort of mining these first-person accounts to write this first book. And here, I found two things. So it's sort of mine for the, you know, writers do this, we sort of mine and read everything we can. And what I'm always interested in is when I read these first-person survivor testimonies, what is left out? That's what fascinates me. And often what happens, sort of the hidden, the sexual, what's happening there, that's always erased, elided, denied. You know, there's all, because questions of morality, shame, et cetera, et cetera. And that's, I'm always drawn, I suppose, to what's left out. And it's this obsession I have with lies and, I mean, with truth. I feel like my obligation is to these characters, who they are. Who are they? And so I just go with it.
Well, in the earlier book, Three Apples Fell from Heaven, by my guest, Michelina Haronian Markham, and by the way, you're listening to Bookworm, I'm Michael Silverblatt, they're the most memorable figure. They're taking the boys away.
Yeah.
And there is a boy who lives in hiding.
Yeah, Sargis.
Yes.
In the attic.
In the attic, in women's clothing.
Yeah.
He's soiling himself. It's not elegant.
No, no.
You know, here we've got, I mean, I find this book fascinating and bizarre. We've got this orphanage. It's called The Nest. It's sort of like the Boys' Academy in Robert Musil's Young Turles.
Yeah,
a good
that's
deal
right.
of torture and nighttime displacement and sexual obsession becomes the subject, gets fused with the losses and the miseries of war, and then in the aftermath get eroticized into the secret life. And that's what fascinated me about the book, because what begins as a virtuous book, full of the attempt to retrieve the lost history, all the things that our time is talking about, you delve into the hidden, the forbidden, the shameful, with a real rigor, it seems to me. Where does that... I think that's the center of your world. My theory about you is that this... the Armenian subject, the genocide, justifies the travel into the realm of the sexually unknowable and forbidden. That's I don't know why. I'd have to ask you.
Don't ask me. I have no idea. That's interesting. You know, there's that epigraph in the first book, "At the edge of love, there we stand." I think these books are about love in a way. I don't know. What you're saying about these books, when you say it, it resonates for me. And I say, that's true. But when I write them, it's not planned for me at all. I literally just followed him. Although I thought a lot about what happens in these institutions where, first of all, desperate poverty, there's certainly no money, there's no food, et cetera, et cetera. Everyone is traumatized. These all-male environments where, you know, the rule of law is the rule of bone. I mean, it's just force and what goes on. I mean, just the sexual stuff, the violence, etc. I mean, I've certainly, that's where this book was going to go in part, I guess. And but as to where that obsession comes from, I don't know.
But obviously, there's both a terror of the subject and a fascination with the subject.
For me.
I think it's true for Jewish writers dealing with the concentration camps as well, that there is the nightmare of history and then the nightmare of the idea of the pre-sexual self awakening into a world of torture and extravagant cruelty.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that we talked about it last time, that this is not the writing of the first generation or even of the second
generation.
That this is the writing of the grandchildren who have had the opportunity to be affected not by the events, but the stories about the events and the way in which in families these will often be the only stories children hear that have sexual content, terrifyingly. So that I think that the later generations of tragedy and catastrophe are influenced into the sadomasochism of that circumstance.
That's interesting. I do know that it's true that, or I believe actually that it has to be the second or third generation to make art in this way. It just simply, I don't think if you've had the experience, you're going to, it's just not possible to make art in this way around it. I mean, again, this question of what can be said and the silence and the shame, and people just need to live, you know? They just need to be able to live. And I am able to go in. I mean, the emotional core I probably did get in some way. I don't know. But it's the dead, really, if you want to know it. It's the dead. And they still haunt me. And, yes, that happens in the families, that the dead are still around. They're talked about. And I don't, you know, that's just part of it. They're sort of hovering or something. How do we even talk about that? But I often think my first obligation is to them. And that's why, for me, it's so important to have integrity with the work. I mean, it's language, obviously, for me. It's the books that I love are when language and story and form, it's at pitch, it's meeting, it's, you know, it's doing everything it can to tell the story. But I often think about, as Sebald said, the dead are ever returning to us. And they are.
Now, in the second part of this book, this man, now essentially in Beirut, he's bringing his experiences and his disintegration to a life and to a marriage, and this becomes a story of a man and a woman to some extent. In other words, the question becomes, what do we do in the world's aftermath of terror when this becomes the private history
of
a couple?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think in this book, the idea, it's the life he lives sort of externally, and then what's happening for him internally, layered. I mean, what comes up, what comes down in his memory and consciousness, etc., brings up for me also questions of seeing. I mean, he's obsessed with seeing, right? That he cannot be seen. He is a carpenter. He's a man who's middle class, lower middle class. He walks around, and suddenly he's having these memories or whatever we're going to call it, a nervous breakdown, God knows. But I do remember I was just so interested in, what are we able to see? Can we see pain? Can we see suffering? Can we see someone who survived a war? Is that seeable? And what does he do with that? And how does he? And it's not possible to share it. That's the thing.
Part of what he does is to look at the world of animals, since they don't speak, and to see, are they suffering?
Jumba.
Yes, exactly.
Chimpanzee.
Could you talk about that a bit? Because it seems such a, you know, extravagant. You know, this is where the work enters the realm of the pathological poetic.
Mm. So there's no zoo in Beirut, by the way. You know, in this book, there's the zoo, and Vahi's going to the zoo. Eventually, he's going every Sunday. He's going on the Sabbath. Instead of going to Mass, he starts going to the zoo. There's a chimpanzee there, et cetera. for me, I mean, what I remember where that came from, because it was just anecdotal, but I was, when I was starting the book and knew I was going to write about an orphan, I heard this anecdote. This journalist, I think was an American, was in Albania, of all places, at the zoo, can you imagine? And it was horrifying. It was, you know, just feces, fecal matter and urine, etc. And there's animals just depressed out of their minds. And he mentioned this chimpanzee who'd been in this very small cage, I don't remember the dimensions, for 40 years. They live a long time like we do. And was a chain smoker. And I just, that image, for me, these books are driven by image. That's why the photographs. That image of that chimpanzee smoking, I just was amazed. And I did tons of research on primates, actually, and volunteered in my zoo and all sorts of things. And then I had no plans about that. It surprised me as much. So I couldn't say, well, then I thought, well, then we'll have the chimp. No. It was simply, I thought, what? Let's mainly put a zoo in Beirut and see what happens. Because for me, it's all, I never know what I'm doing, in a way. I write up to, you know, as far as I can see, it's about a half a foot in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I just write, I'm just always writing up right to my edge all the time. And I am as surprised about what's going on, because I know Vahe, or I know my character, by writing him. And Jumba, too. Jumba is not, he's not a symbol. He's Jumba. He's a chimpanzee, and he's in this book. I wasn't interested in anthropomorphizing him or anything of the sort, actually.
And yet, well, my theme song says you are a human animal.
Yeah.
This is a chimp who's smoking.
Yeah.
And this is a man who has become identified with animality. As you speak in an interview, what happens when, in war, a human being becomes an animal? So this is a meeting point.
Yes, yes. Always during war, and we can look at the war now in Iraq, too, always the language is always the same. You debase the other is a dog, almost always a dog. It's quite interesting. A dog, a brute.
Vermin.
Vermin, exactly. There's some need for the killers, always, to justify, to not be monsters, to say, no, it's because they are vermin, they are this, they are that, that it's not possible to the self somehow to be a monster, to say, well, I'm erasing them, I'm killing them, I want their land. No, there's always some...
I want something.
You know, there's always some narrative. This fascinates me, the narrative that needs to go on to justify patriotism, we need this, we'll tell some story about democracy, or in the Turk case, we'll tell some story about they're trying to do this to us, or they're dogs, or they're less than human, they're going to take over. We understand these narratives.
I'm fascinated by the title, I have to say, because I think a person, you know, going to a shelf sees the daydreaming boy. Well, that sounds nice.
That's very
I'm
nice.
A daydreamer.
It's quite pedestrian or something, actually,
well,
isn't it?
Yeah, and daily, you know, it might be about someone with attention deficit syndrome, or you know, someone who, like Walter Mitty, who drifts into altered states that are quite nominally sweet and return. Why did you choose a gentle title, given the ferocity of the material?
Probably for that reason, actually. I've loved just strange juxtapositions of that sort. I think it opens up space in the language and in story, but or the text. And, of course, he at one point early on in the book starts to remember this other orphan who's obsessed with Vostanig, and he starts sort of descending into the fantasy, gets layered and layered and layered, and he says, when he's remembering his time in the orphanage, he says, he remembers his teacher who used to beat them if they looked like they weren't paying attention. He says, I am the daydreaming boy, but he can't see it. This whole question of seeing and his understanding that he was always someone externally different from who he was internally, and just this idea of the daydream. I actually quite love it. I did take the dash out. Did you notice that? That it had to go together, you know, this idea. Because it is happening for him in his life. It's happening during the day.
Now, when he gets deeper into memory, as you say, the memory gets more and more layered. But I wondered how that happens, what that does to the process of composition. When you're writing a character who is fusing so many things at once, and you're not like the kind of writer would be explaining these thoughts. You want to represent them.
Yes.
And you want the reader to feel that layer and that miasma, really. Mm. How do you do that? I sometimes felt reading this book that narration came most naturally to you, and explanation was more difficult.
I think the book does move at a pitch, and it really towards the end that stuff gets very high pitched. How do I do it?
Yeah.
I just try to get out of the way of myself. And for me, these books are often about some kind of dissent, and I have to get my brain out of the way so I can get the work done. It feels like a dissent to me. That's what this book felt like. Into him or into his mind or into this world, which took a long time to get to create. But once I was there, I don't know. I write to the edge of what I know, and I just kept moving there and moving there and moving there. And what I knew actually comes out as the book. And I knew a little bit more and more and more until I sort of had some kind of arc. And I couldn't have planned it. It wasn't like I planned it or, you know.
Usually when people use words like dissent, they're talking about an abyss or more actually about hell. Mm. Is this character's mind hell?
God, what a question, Michael. I don't know. What's hell?
I don't know. That's why. Yeah. But I'm interested that you allude to it
as a dissent.
Yeah.
I don't know that hell makes sense. But it is, it's a dissent. It's something. It's the language itself is sort of move. It feels like this downward movement to me. I wouldn't characterize it as hell per se, but it's deep in the folds of the mind and the spirit, and it's hard to articulate, actually. I mean, I had to keep trying to open the language, English, up to get him on this page. It was quite fun, actually, in terms of punctuation, but intense. I felt like it was the language. I mean, you'll notice in the book there are just blank spaces towards the end because there are no words for this. How do you write this suffering, this despair? How do you do it? You sort of write around it, in a way. You create, you hollow it out.
I've been speaking to Micheline Aharonian-Markham, the author most recently of The Daydreaming Boy. It's a novel published by Riverhead Books. It's a real pleasure having you here. I look forward to the third book in the trilogy, and thank you for coming.
Thank you very much. It's my pleasure.
You can read an excerpt from The Daydreaming Boy on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical director is Ray Guarna. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse Pop Time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.